So perhaps I can finish a calculation from last time. Just sketching a calculation from last time. And then move on to discuss the spectrum string theory, a boson string theory in a ad hoc way. So see what are some of the actors from the last time. I wrote this operator, the derivative of x in terms of modes. I wrote the stress tensor, defining it by a limiting procedure. And I also wrote every mode the composition of the stress tensor. And I said that if you run through this definition and you apply it to this Fourier expansion, you can reconstruct some expression for the LNs, which is useful, but not great. So I say this is a cute expression, but and it's good for seeing how Ls act on a state. But it might be a little tricky to compute the commutator of Ls using this expression. At some point, we'd like to figure out what's the algebra of these Ls. And when you do commutators, you might end up having infinite sums, which are unpleasant if you do them directly using this definition, this formula, which is not a definition. This is the definition. So a safer procedure to figure out the algebra of the Ls is that to ask how do they act on some operators. So, I mean, at the end, of course, how can I say this? You can also just say, okay, I'm just going to act on a bunch of states and check the commutator on those states and then reconstruct the commutator, and that's perfectly fine. By asking how they act on operators, I'm just doing a whole bunch of these calculations at the same time. The whole Fock space, the whole Hilbert space can be built by acting with the modes of these on the grad, on the vacuum. So at the end, we pretty much need to just figure out how the Ls act on this field. So now you guys study some conformal field theory, so you could also use conformal field theory techniques to get these answers using OPEs and so on. In these lectures, I'm trying to keep it to sort of a free field theory perspective. Now, one thing you can easily compute, because there are no infinite sums to worry about, is this. If you check what that means in terms of the current, you find something like this. And it's definitely consistent with the idea that this acts as a transformation, coordinate transformation, you know, S goes to some function of S, an infinitesimal one. So I think there is a type, no, I meant this. Right. So L, this is literally the L acts on the scalar field as a diffeomorphism on the scalar field. So that's what I was trying to write, my bad. Now, if you take a derivative, you can find how it acts on dx. It's just the derivative of this. Or if you want, it's this. Well, I think I'll leave it at that. So, perhaps it's useful to expand it out a little bit. So there is an obvious term. And then there is an extra piece. And this is pretty much the obvious transformation of a tensor with one index. Pretty much, there is a, you know, the diffeomorphism, the vector field acts by just transporting it, but also rotating the index. Okay. Now, by the same token, we can compute what happens to ds, to sort of dx s prime. And this allows you to then apply this definition and do a careful calculation of what happens, how L acts on the stress tensor. And you get sort of three terms. One is the one you would expect, sort of. I mean, two terms that are pretty straightforward, which are just the naive way a tensor with two indices would transform. And then there is a bit of an anomaly. I hope I have that expression here. It's something like n squared, n cubed over 12 e to the ns. I mean, it's just an infinitesimal form of a more general statement. So if you start from this expression, you change coordinates. You're going to compare this subtraction with something like 1 over f of s minus f of s prime squared. So if you change coordinates, the definition of the stress tensor will change. I mean, if you compare the definition of the stress tensor in the two coordinate systems, you find the usual transformation of a tensor with two indices and an extra term, which is pretty much the difference between these quantities. I invite you to try to compute this. It's fun. It's a finite amount. It's something called the Schwarzian derivative. FF. And this is the infinitesimal version, so this is pretty much the Swanson derivative of 1 plus of e to the a and s. Okay, and then from this expression you can derive the Virasoro algebra that we wrote down last time with the central charge and everything. So, right, so you can either use these methods or you can use OPEs. That's also something you've probably done in the confort field theory class. Okay. What you really don't want to do is to work with modes directly. So, next I would like to sort of learn how to impose the condition that the stress tensor vanishes. This is the classical constraint that came from having H fixed the metric away. Now, how do you impose quantum mechanically these sort of conditions? It's a bit of a pain. What do you remember of this sort of question in QED? Have you done QED, some QED? I forget. Have you encountered any situation where you had a constraint to impose? Like,
I guess the physical state has to be like neutral or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like under some charge.
Right, so you need to. Depends on which gauge you are working in. So typically a situation, what people sometimes say is that you would like to make sure that the stress tensor vanishes between physical states. Something like that. Now, of course, we need to decide which stress tensor vanishes, which coordinate system, because the stress tensor gets shifted under coordinate transformations. So that's already a bit of a subtlety. But how do you figure that out? So the right, it's hard to get the right answers without doing a proper gauge fixing quantum mechanically and introducing ghosts. So we'll do that next. For now, I'll have to sort of put in some numbers, some normal ordering prescriptions by hand. You just have to trust it until you derive it in a better way. So for example, typically after saying this, you would say something like, okay, let me expand it in Fourier modes. And a natural way to impose, it's a bit redundant to try to ask for the L's, for all the L's to kill the physical states. And indeed, it's not possible. Or you can try to do something where the distraction, that the L's that lower the energy kill the physical states. Well, the creation operators kill the bus. And then you need to sort of impose and figure out what to do with L0. I cannot just say, okay, I'll impose this L0 minus 1 kill the physical states. And this minus 1 is one of the things that you just need to believe for now. Another thing that you need to believe for now is that we need 26 directions in space-time. So these two numbers are the ones that we'll need ghosts to get to. But once you do something like that, then you can kind of get things to work. The idea is that now you look at the states. You also observe that if a physical state is obtained from the action of L minus n's on something, then it will be orthogonal to all the physical states. So you probably want to throw it away. So in this sort of ad hoc quantization, you look for the kernel of Ln and L0 minus 1, and you divide it by the image of L minus n's. And that's the space of states. I mean, I should really say the intersection between the kernel. And the image. Okay. So, as in gauge theory, this procedure is really important. And we can see manifestations of these in the fact that if you don't do these sort of things, you'll find states which have negative norm. Why does it happen? Well, we studied a single scalar field. But now let's restore the Lorentz indices. So for a single scalar field, we had something like this. Now, if I have a collection of scalar fields, I need to put Lorentz indices. These scalar fields are supposed to be directions in space-time. Right? We're really talking about some x mu's, not just x. And you want a space-time which is nice and Lorentzian, 25,1 signature. So what do I need to put on the right-hand side to make this Lorentz invariant?
At a mu.
That's right. So we find a problem that Lorentz symmetry mixes operators which would look like raising operators for space directions, and an operator looks like a lowering operator in the time direction, or vice versa. If you consider this the norm of a state like these, a state created in terms of A's, well, this will give you any time you knew. So the zero polarization will be negative definite. And this is very similar to what you saw in electromagnetism. In electromagnetism, there are the modes of the gauge field, or the gauge potential, and the modes of A0 have the wrong norm. So it creates states of null or negative norm. And in this context, the way you resolve it was precisely by imposing some gauge gauge fixing and removing pure gauge things. Right, so if I were to look at the, so instead of looking at all four polarizations, you look at polarizations which are orthogonal to the momentum and then get rid of the ones that are along the momentum. And here we'll find something very similar. Indeed, these sort of constraints will look very similar to requiring the polarizations to be perpendicular to a momentum. And this will be very similar to throwing away polarizations which are longitudinal. Now, finally, I just realized that in the last lecture was probably not. I wrote a lot about the A's. I should have been a bit more careful to keep, you know, keep track of the fact that there is both the X and del bar X. And this has the A-N's inside, and these are A-bar-N's. Right, so the Fock space is really built out of both type of operators. Any questions? Okay, I can continue. So we're going to look at this hyperspace with all of the states and start imposing these conditions. And we're going to start with L0 and L0 bar. Let's start with the first state, or family of states, really. So we saw that what is L0 minus 1 acting on this? This is p squared minus square root 2 minus 1. And L0 bar luckily has the same expression. So if you want to look at something which is satisfying the constraint, we need p squared is equal to 2. Furthermore, such a state will never be in the image of some else which increase the energy, because it's the ground state in the given momentum sector. So we're done. So this family of states is in the spectrum. So how would you call an object which has particles, particle-like things of momentum, of given momentum, momentum squared, and labeled by the momentum? Well, this look like the mode, the particles of a scalar field. So this part of the string spectrum looks like a scalar field with some on-shell condition, which sets it to be a tachyon. Here I've wrote shu, because I'm sort of ignoring the factor, the tension in front of the action. There's really chu in some units. Whatever were the parameter t I put in front of my action. So it's a scale that is built in the model. These states I can throw away right away because they have different values of L0 and L0 bar. So I'll never be able to satisfy this kind of conditions. So for states in the spectrum, L0 minus L0 bar has to be 0. Luckily, L0 minus L0 bar is the spin. So, sorry, is the moment, is the Kaluza-Klein momentum. In other words, it's literally the momentum of a state on the worksheet. So it's quantized. So L0 minus L0 bar is always an integer. So asking for it to be 0 doesn't require a miracle. It's just, you know, one of many options. So here, this is the next state, which has L0 equal to 0 bar. And This changes the value of L0 by 1. So this has L0 equal to p squared over 2. 0 minus 1 equal to p squared over 2. And so the on-shell condition now is just that p squared is 0. That's nice. This is going to describe some massless states. That has some kind of, and let me put a polarization of some sort. I mean, I want to take a linear combination of these. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to satisfy the other conditions. So the next I need to check that it's killed by L1, L2, L3, and so forth. Here it was automatic because this is the ground state. So if I try to act with modes that lower the energy, I get 0. Here I can land on something with less energy. So if I act with, say, L1, so L1 has terms that look like A0, A1, plus dot, dot, dot. So A1 will kill the A-1. A0 acts as the momentum. So roughly, this gives you P mu epsilon mu nu P A bar nu minus 1 P equal to 0. And so we get a constraint on the polarization. P mu epsilon mu nu P is equal to 0, and also P nu epsilon mu nu P equal to 0 from acting with L bar 1. We're not done, because it's also possible to get a state like this by trying to act with L minus 1 on something. So if I take a state which looks like, what's a good name for a gauge parameter, lambda? Lambda nu A bar nu minus 1 p, and I act with L1 and minus 1, this L minus 1, which has inside A0, A minus 1, plus stuff, then I'm going to get something like lambda nu p mu A mu minus 1, A bar nu minus 1, P. So we learned that we need to throw away states of the form, or if you want, we have a gauge symmetry of some sort, where we shift the polarization by something proportional to the momentum. So we have two gauge symmetries, each with 4 entries. Now, this might look a little unfamiliar still, but we can make it more familiar by projecting on decomposing this into irreducible representations of the Lorentz group. So this was just a tensor. If I have a tensor, I can break it into pieces. I can take the symmetric part, the antisymmetric part, and the trace. So I can decompose my epsilon as a symmetric, as an antisymmetric part, symmetric part, as a trace. Okay, I'm not sure I want to present them. Let's say an antisymmetric part, a symmetric part. Okay, let me start the symmetric one. Symmetric traceless. A antisymmetric one and a trace and a diagonal part. So if I decompose this in such a manner, um, the gauge transformations here become something like a shift by P mu lambda nu plus P nu lambda mu minus the trace, something like that. And actually, sorry, the decomposition in symmetric and trace is a little messy always. I always get confused explaining it, but let me ignore that for now. So this should remind you of something. It should remind you of the gauge transformations of a graviton. Because when I have, in gravity, I have the metric, right, which gets transformed by infinitesimally like that when you do a diffeomorphism. And once you move to momentum space, this becomes something like that. This piece comes depending on how you gauge fix your graviton fluctuations. I'm not going to worry about that. So here you find kind of a spin true particle, massless particle. Here you find a bit of a weirder transformation, which has sort of P mu lambda nu, lambda tilde, minus P nu lambda tilde mu. This is unfamiliar. It's you encounter these sort of gauge transformations if you study gauge fields with two components, with two indices. So I don't remember particles. Right, particles have an action like these, but if you couple them to electromagnetism, you also get a term like that. Now, what would you couple to a string? So you integral of the area, but then I need something I can integrate on a two-dimensional surface. I cannot couple a standard gauge field to a string easily, but if I have a beam in U which is antisymmetric, then I can couple it to something like the x mu over the U1, the x nu over the U2. So as this coupling doesn't use the metric on the target space or on the worksheet. If you know what forms are, this is the pullback of a true form from space-time to the worksheet. But anyway, this sort of field that can couple to a string, it's a one-form gauge field. Sorry, a two-form gauge field. It's a gauge field for some gauge symmetry. It's a gauge symmetry which has an extra index. This was called a one-form gauge symmetry. This happens in places. In four dimensions, we don't usually care about these sort of things, because if you start from a true form gauge field, the field strength of that has three indices. And then you can dualize it to a scalar field. So in four dimensions, if you have a standard electromagnetic field, you can exchange electric and magnetic field to get another dual electromagnetic field. This electromagnetic duality. If you apply to it something with two indices, you end up with something with zero indices. So in four dimensions, what you call an axion can also be thought of as a two-form gauge field. But in dimension 26, you can write all sorts of weird gauge fields. And in particular, there is a gauge field that naturally couples to strings. And so perhaps it's unsurprising that string theory produces one for you. We will learn in a future lecture how to understand that this is really a field, a B field that couples to the strings in the way you would expect it to. And then here there is an extra lonely massless scalar, which is called the dilaton. And we will learn how to see that this actually controls the coupling of the string theory. So the string theory comes with this collection of massless modes. We'll see that one controls deformations of the metric, one controls an extra B field, and one controls deformations of the coupling. Now you could rightfully ask, you know, how do I know that this is a metric? Actually, once you convince yourself, and this might not be immediately obvious, that at low energy string theory behaves like a field theory, there are also two theorems in field theory that if you have a spin through massless field, the way it can couple to matter is very, very restricted by gauge symmetry unitarity. So whenever you see a massless spin through gauge field, it's a graviton. Like the only action it can have is the Einstein-Hilbert action plus higher curvature corrections. The only way it can couple to matter is through the stress tensor and so on and so forth. So to the moment you see a spin through massless thing, you kind of know that this theory is going to have some form of gravity. Now, of course, we are not done. We can keep going. We can look at things like I minus 2 mu, A minus 2 nu plus blah, blah, blah. Same thing with A minus 1, mu 1, A minus 1, mu 2, A minus 2 nu. Get some linear combination of what are things that have energy true about the vacuum. You get some monstrosity with up to four indices and with mass squared minus two. So now positive mass, but you know, non-tachyonic, just very massive things. With increase with a lot of indices. And you keep going, you're going to find infinitely many states of increasing mass. So at states of mass 2 minus 2n. With spin up to 2n plus 2. So infinite tower of increasingly massive modes of higher spin. This is a standard feature of perturbative string theory. And now, one feature of string theory that we'll see later on is that it cures some of the problems of perturbative quantum gravity. So it cures the sort of problems you encounter in perturbation theory, which are not all the problems you encounter in quantum gravity, but they are some of the problems you might encounter in quantum gravity. So it's hard to write down so quantum gravity is not UV complete as an effective field theory. There are divergences, even at two loops. You get infinitely many counter terms. You cannot, it's not normalizable. There is a bad behavior of amplitudes at high energy. At some point, scattering amplitudes just start having probabilities that go above one. So things break down. And this infinite tower of massive particles that you encounter in string theory conspires to make the UV behavior more gentle. It's like, imagine expanding an exponential in powers of x. Individual powers are badly divergent, but they can conspire to give a very small number. So the string theory scattering amplitudes decay exponentially fast at a very high energy. And there are kind of theorems that the only way you can do so in a theory which has gravitons is indeed to have an infinite tower of particles with higher and higher mass and spin. So kind of the way it would have to be. So if you want to cure the perturbative problems of gravity within perturbation theory at some intermediate scale, which is much lower than the Planck scale, then pretty much the only way to go is to have infinitely many particles with infinite spin appear at this scale. And string theory gives you a way to produce examples of this.
Mm-hmm. Are there other examples?
Other string theories? I don't know. Not sure. I've seen people study some deformations of string theory amplitudes, which I'm not sure come from string theory, and that share some features. Kuhn's amplitudes are called, but I know nothing about them, so I cannot express a valid opinion. I think people are also trying to see sort of using the bootstrap that you must have these towers. Sort of doing mass bootstrapping the S-matrix of gravity. Although the moment has been mostly done in 10 dimensions with very supersymmetric theories that look like string theory at low energy. Yes, I think it's a... No, there is no... I mean, nobody says that the problems of gravity have to be resolved perturbably. The perturbative problems of gravity have to be resolved at some scale lower than the Planck scale. There are definite alternatives. In M theory, there is no such intermediate scale, and no tower of particles or whatever. We don't know what happens, obviously, in our universe, because we cannot check all the way to the Planck to see what happens up to the Planck scale.
I guess it's like a miracle that like string theory leads one to find like non-perturbative definitions of gravity, right? Because like what one can sort of go from string theory to M theory and stuff like that, like guess the non-perturbative definition. So it's like a miracle a little bit, no? Because it's just a perturbation theory, but it also like reveals some.
It's supersymmetric. See, it's tricky. Holography makes things really tricky. See, for example, we have two CFTs. The CFT that describes low energy behavior of M5 brains, and the CFT that describes low energy behavior of M2 brains. Each of these at large N gives us an holographic dual background, which we call M theory, on ADS5 times ADS4 times S7, or ADS7 times S4. These are non-perturbative definitions of this M theory. They preserve all of the supersymmetry, a lot of supersymmetry. And in there, you will find manifestations of all sorts of string dualities and of these hints that you're talking about that you get from string theory, that there is an underlying non-perturbative thing. And those hints apply to both descriptions. So there are hints that there exist non-perturbative things. And yeah, there is a non-perturbative definition in ADS4 times S7, or in ADS7 times S4. And you can take the radius of ADS7 or ADS4 to be very large, and that will approach flat space. So they sort of tell you that things must make sense in some way also in flat 11 dimensional space time. Now, can we prove that they give the same 10-dimensional space-time limit, 11-dimensional space-time limit, the same low-energy effective action? We definitely expect it to be the case. And perhaps you can even prove it using some trick, in the sense that there are configurations in each of these theories which represent the other type of brains. Like you can do something in the theory of M5 brains such that in the holographic dual, there are M2 brains hanging around in some part of space-time, and vice versa. So maybe now you can take a limit, some kind of double limit, where you now take a lot of these M2 brains and you do duality again in some sense. So I can definitely believe that you can show that these two CFTs give you the same non-perturbative completion or definition of M theory in flat space. Now, there are an enormous amount of other 3D CFTs that give me M theory in spaces of the form ADS4 times some seven-dimensional manifold. Do they all give the same flat space limit? I definitely hope so. They have less and less supersymmetry. We don't know how to check that they give the same non-perturbative answers for the flat space. I'm perfectly happy to accept it as a conjecture, but it's just to say that in principle, you can imagine scenarios where these non-perturbative completions are not actually the same. So, you know, if one wants to be as conservative as possible, although, of course, you know, if you, see, it's, you start getting into the joke, you know, if you see a cow that is from the train, it looks white, you know, can you say all cows are white? Can you say cows here are white? Or you can say that only this half of the cow is white. So perhaps, I don't know, I shouldn't be too suspicious. I definitely am ready to accept that all of these give the same flat space non-perturbative completion. But I guess I'm trying to say that, yes, we definitely have a lot of hints that these perturbative string theories have a non-perturbative thing behind. And we also know the non-perturbative things which give these string theories. So these hints are realized. Is the non-perturbative completion uniquely characterized by the perturbative data? That we don't know. It would be very nice to know. Definitely, supersymmetry imposes a lot of constraints. So a lot of the sort of supersymmetric parts of these non-perturbative completions are fixed by supersymmetry. It would be nice to know what, you know, nice to go beyond that. Or even for the supersymmetric parts, you know, it would be nice to check that they're really the same in some reasonable sense. So that's one of the reasons I'm curious about twisted holography, which is sort of a way to take a supersymmetric piece of supersymmetric quantum field theory, such as a holographic dual, and get out a supersymmetric piece of the string theory and theory. So, you know, Kevin has some powerful theorems in this twisted context. Say things like, you know, the supersymmetric this supersymmetric piece of supergravity has a unique counterterms a unique low energy effective action, if you want, if you assume that deep brains exist. That's a powerful result. I would really love to know if similar results can be given beyond the protected piece. So how unique is non-perturbative completion of string theory? I think it's a fun question. Meaning, if you take two non-perturbative descriptions of universes which look different at infinity, but then you deform them so that they look the same at infinity, do the non-perturbative descriptions agree?
But that would be like a finite deformation, right? I would have to do like place an infinite amount of brains in a bulk or something like that.
Yeah, you have to do large volume limits or things like that. Right. But at the very least, you can ask: am I getting the same, right, the same string theory, the same low energy theory? The same M theory. Okay, so we have a little bit of extra time. Let's see. Do you have questions?
Yeah, I guess what makes me suspicious that there is a single theory is that like the different asymptotics give like completely different spectra of states, and like then the UV definition sort of is completely different. So I cannot see like how they're supposed to give the same theory. But when I add a lot of brains, I should somehow get it.
Right.
Make them back the acting.
Because they all go to flat space, right?
Yes.
In a sense, if inside this under the sitter space, I do a little scattering experiment in a little lab, do I get the same answers? I think that's a fun question, which is starting to become manageable in some corners.
Would I expect the same answers if I did a small experiment? Because I know that the UV spectrum is given by the IR, so yeah.
It's a fun question. Yeah, I agree. At which point the effective field theory knows? At which point do we start encountering some UVIR mixing in the answers? Yeah.
I guess it also might be that at like very high energy we start seeing it. Maybe we don't see that at our scale, but if we go to even small distances, then we start seeing the IR.
It's possible.
Because like we produce a lot of black holes, and like black holes have different spectra and there's different asymptotics or something.
Yeah, that would be a possibility, for example, absolutely. But if you look at the microstates of a black hole in these different theories, as you're saying, do they resemble each other? Or do they know that I'm in a different universe? Yeah, that's a very good example. Do the microstates of the black hole depend on the universe you're in? Mm-hmm.
Just a clarification question to make sure that I understand what we have been doing. So that. In order to get the spectrum, we have to impose some constraints.
Yes.
Them being the relations on the left, mm-hmm. expressed in terms of the kernels of Ln, Lz,
yes.
one. I guess we are removing L minus N because we have already counted it.
Hmm?
Why are we removing the image of L minus N?
So, because if I have something which is L minus 1 or something else, then it's orthogonal to physical states. So if I have a state which is orthogonal to all other states, I don't want to keep it, because if I keep it, I don't have a Hilbert space. Hilbert space of states is supposed to have a positive definite non-degenerate inner product.
And then what we're doing is that we're starting with all the physical states that we can make out of creation operators.
Yes.
And acting with the Ls to see what the constraint.
Well, we're taking all the states of the worksheet theory, which are not all the states of the string theory, because string theory is the worksheet theory plus the constraint.
Yes.
So we take all the states of the string of the worksheet theory. We restrict the ones that satisfy the physical state condition. And then we quotient by the ones that are null. And then we pray that what's left is positive definite, because it's still not obvious.
Yes.
Here in these particular examples, you can see that once you throw away these, once you impose this constraint and you throw away this stuff, then you get a positive definite inner product. In principle, you had to check that at every single level. And there is people who did this. There is something called the Nogos theorem, which shows you that the spectrum is indeed positive definite. There are various ways to show it. One way is to just abandon Lorentz invariant for a moment, pretty much take the momentum to be in direction 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. So that when you throw away and argue that pretty much you're just throwing away all polarizations in these two directions, and the things that are left are polarizations in the other directions. And so pretty much you get a big tower of representations of SO24. And that magically rearrange themselves into representations of the little group, which is SO25. When the mass is non-zero. So that's one way. It's called the Lightcon gauge. And the other option is to do BRST quantization properly, but then you need to show the Nogos theorem, BRST quantization. So you still need to prove a theorem.
So isn't it a bit non-trivial that decoupling null states also decouples the negative norm states?
Absolutely. So as I said, it's not obvious that you get a positive definite inner product at the end.
Okay. Yeah.
So, absolutely.
Is there some connection to like minimal models or something like that? Because there's some.
Well, what I could say is that, as you can see, the calculation is done within more representations of Virasoro. So if you take a primary field and you look at all of its descendants, then there is a bit of a, then you just care about how the primary field behaves and how its descendants behave. So you can guess that there is some property of Virasoro algebra at C equal to 26 and delta equal to 1 that we are using. Because we are imposing, no, when we are imposing that this condition tells you that you are a primary field in Virasoro. And then you're saying it's a primary field of dimension 1. And then in there, we worry that there might still be things to throw away, right? We are trying to throw away things which happens to be themselves descendants, even though they were primaries. So the theory of unitary representation, the representation theory of the Virasoro algebra, it's funny. I mean, there are regions in the space of central charges and in the scaling dimension where the primary, the modules generated by a primary have a nice positive definite inner product. We're definitely not there because we're finding null states that we need to throw away. So I guess one might try to prove the Nogos theorem by arguing that representations with this delta at C equal 26 can contain only some specific null states, and after I get rid of them, what's left is positive definite. So yeah, I think it's a tool that you could use. Indeed, when the, I think what you're thinking, when you were studying minimum models, there was a big plot, right, where you precisely studied the unitarity of certain representations of the Virasoro algebra. Now, on top of that, though, see, when I say that the representations are unitary for the Virasoro algebra, I mean that if the primary norm is positive, all the descendants norm are positive. But there is still the issue, are these that norms of these primaries positive to start with? The Virasoro algebra would not know that. That's an information that comes from the rest of the theory. So I don't think this representation theory of Virasoro would be enough. It's definitely, it needs to cooperate for things to work. But then the no-ghost is still a stronger issue. Right, so the no-ghost theorem is pretty much the idea that after you get rid of all the Virasoro algebra stuff, then what's left is positive definite. And indeed, right, the constraint we're trying to impose is that the stress tensor is zero. So effectively, we are just trying to get rid of the Virasoro algebra. It's like we have the conformal field theory. It has all of these primary fields of the Virasoro algebra and all of their descendants. And we are trying to somehow throw away all the descendants and focus on the primary fields only in a consistent way. And then these primary fields also, we want them to be to have a positive definite in the product. So when we do BRST quantization, we'll learn how to introduce some ghosts whose job is precisely to cancel the Virasoro algebra. So there is some, you know, you add extra stuff, but then you define an odd symmetry which pairs up things and allows you to throw them away. And things that are, the only thing that are not paired up are sort of the ones that are in the physical spectrum. All right, so I will devote a little bit of time in the next lecture trying to explain this idea of canceling bosons against fermions and doing BRST cohomology in some examples. But I never know what is the right starting point for the